Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, bringing the facts, stories and people behind the science. In this podcast, I'm talking with Professor Shabir Madi, Dean of the Faculty of Health Sciences at the University of Witwatersrand, but also a professor of vaccinology. And he's going to tell us about his experiences of the pandemic in South Africa and also his work on developing vaccines for COVID-19 and some of the events which occurred after the vaccines were licensed in South Africa to give us some insight into an experience from the Southern Hemisphere. Professor Shabir Madi, Dean in the Faculty of Health Sciences at the University of Witwatersrand and Professor of Vaccinology, paediatric researcher working on the epidemiology of childhood infectious disease and trials of vaccines, most notably pneumonia, influenza and rotavirus over some decades now. Shabir, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Andy.
So, Shabir, you grew up in South Africa and you grew up during a period where South Africa was very troubled during apartheid. And I just wonder whether those experiences were some of the reasons why you decided to study medicine and to work in this field.
Yeah, so Andy, indirectly, growing up under apartheid and being fairly restricted in terms of job opportunities for someone of color, I was somewhat forced into doing medicine in that it wasn't my first choice, but under sort of parental pressure, it was determined that that would be the best choice for me in relation to gaining some level of job security, which wouldn't be dependent on the state. Because in 1984, when I finished my schooling career, we were still at the height of apartheid in terms of oppression, in terms of limited opportunities for people of color. And that's the reason why, rather than doing chemical engineering, I ended up doing medicine.
So was it chemical engineering you wanted to do and your parents decided medicine was a more secure future?
Yeah, and so did the people that I received my bursary from. I did try to switch in my first year from medicine to chemical engineering. But unfortunately, the grantors of my bursary indicated that they wouldn't be supporting me any further if I did make that switch. And with my parents not being able to afford the university fees, I was somewhat forced into a corner of completing what my father probably really desired more than I did.
Well, I think that's been very good for the world that you were forced into that because of the huge contributions you've made during your career. Were your parents scientists? Did they have some sort of insight into what you might be able to do with a career in medicine?
No, I think my father was a school teacher. He did mathematics, and in fact, he was my school teacher when I was at school. My mother was really in the home industry, supporting the family from working from home. So certainly they didn't have a scientific background. And certainly I think the furthest thing in my father's mind was that I wouldn't be a practicing doctor, but I would be doing research. I don't think that featured in his calculus as to what it meant to become a medical doctor. But that being said, it's largely, again, because of apartheid and the end of apartheid in this instance that sort of created opportunity for me to enter into the space of research, which I certainly wouldn't have been offered opportunity of embarking on had I graduated even a few years earlier. So it's really sort of a mixture of fortunes that the stars aligned. And I ended up graduating at a time when there was some change taking place on a political front in South Africa, which opened up the opportunity of me entering into a position which I was ill-equipped to do at that stage, but largely because many of the people that were equipped to actually undertake those sort of responsibilities in clinical research had largely emigrated from the country. So there was this gap opportunity that arose because of apartheid coming to an end.
So as you qualified for medicine and you took up a paediatric career working in South Africa, your experiences must have been very different from mine. I mean, we're almost contemporaries. I think you're about a year behind me, but we've actually followed relatively similar paths in terms of clinical and our research interests. And I just wondered, as a junior paediatrician, what the experiences were in South Africa at that time. So this, I guess, would have been in the early 90s.
Correct. So this was, I started my paediatric training in 1994, and that was at a time when the new dispensation came into being in South Africa. And what was really striking then, this was at a really sort of the early stages of the HIV, relatively early stages of the HIV pandemic, epidemic in South Africa. And what was striking is that over a period of a few years, during the course of my 4-year training as a pediatrician, We went from one major vaccine preventable disease to what essentially overwhelmed our healthcare facilities, and that was pediatric HIV. I graduated at a time when close on to one third of the children that were being hospitalized didn't leave the hospital. And much of that was driven by HIV. But what was also striking during my training as a pediatrician is the large amount of vaccine preventable diseases which children were dying from. And in the early 1990s, despite these vaccines being available since the 1930s, 1940s, and 1960s, what we still found in South Africa is children dying of neonatal tetanus. What we found in South Africa is children dying of measles, vaccines that were deployed globally. But in South Africa at that stage, we didn't have a public immunization program. And the large majority of the population during the course of my training as a pediatrician were not vaccinated against these life-threatening illnesses. And especially measles is something which keeps at the back of my mind, because we simply used to run out of isolation facilities. And we ended up having larger wards that were housing children with measles than we had wards that housed children with other non-communicable diseases, as an example.
So I think it's very helpful to have sort of set up the context of South Africa and your experiences in the hospital. And we don't have time today to talk about your career in vaccine development, which has been so critical and has had such a big impact on the use of vaccines around the world. But I would like to take us now to the pandemic. And we really, I think, started to become properly aware of that in the general public here in the UK towards the end of January into February of 2020. And then we had our first big wave of disease following shortly after the Italian experience in early 2020, and we finally went into lockdown in March of 2020. So I guess from South Africa, you were watching all of this happening. What was the impression from the country, from the government, from the media at that time?
In South Africa is that as soon as the government got wind that we were potentially facing a major challenge, they decided to embark on a lockdown. And that lockdown, if my memory serves me correct, was sometime in the middle of March, probably around about the same time as when the UK actually went into the lockdown. And South Africa was fairly aggressive in that they had different sort of levels of lockdown, graded from level one to level five, where level five essentially shut down all sort of engagement in society other than for essential services. So they embarked on this lockdown at a relatively early stage, initially indicating that it would be for a period of 3 weeks. And then as things continued to evolve, it was clearly evident that what they attempted to achieve with a lockdown was not materializing, and they decided to expand it by a further 2 weeks. But what basically led to that extension of the lockdown was still perhaps not just uniquely to South Africa, but probably sort of a global lack of understanding as to what we truly faced, was the notion that we would somehow still be able to eliminate the virus from the country and be somewhat immune from further importation of the virus from other countries should we go into high levels of restriction at the early stage.
Was that lockdown happening in the face of large numbers of cases and hospitals filling up in South Africa, or was it more that the government was looking at what was happening in Europe?
Yeah, it's very much what the government was looking at what was happening in Europe. In fact, I clearly remember at a time when we went into the lockdown, there were just a handful of cases, individuals that had traveled to Italy that actually had returned to South Africa that were tested by the NICD that tested positive for COVID. So it wasn't even more than a handful of cases that were identified at that stage in South Africa when the government actually went into lockdown. But as you mentioned, it was sort of somewhat also informed or precipitated by the images that were coming across on televisions in terms of what was happening in Spain, in Italy, and many other European countries, where we saw all of a sudden massive number of hospitalizations take place. And I remember sort of ambulances of corpses lining the road. And that certainly created panic on the part of government, and it felt it needed to do whatever was necessary to avoid the same from happening in South Africa.
I guess here there were so many cases and the hospitals were starting to come under pressure, so it was relatively easy when the stay-at-home order came to persuade people that was the right thing to do. And in fact, compliance for the population was actually much better than anyone expected would be the case. Was that different in South Africa, given that there wasn't the same pressures on the system?
Yeah, it certainly was different. And I think the other important dimension to this whole issue is that South Africa is a very unequal society, unfortunately. And many people literally survive from hand to mouth on a daily basis. They need to go out in an informal sector to earn a living to put bread on the table. And there aren't too many social securities in place to actually assist people not to go out to seek some sort of nominal income to for the family to survive. So it's a very different sort of context where your families don't have the sort of reserves to be able to go into a lockdown without some form of social support. So what ended up happening in South Africa is because there wasn't that same sort of urgency that was being experienced at a public level, coupled with the realities that we face in terms of this, of the economic divide, the only way that government effectively was able to actually enforce the lockdown was to actually deploy the army, which itself created further tensions in society because people didn't feel immediately threatened by what was happening outside. Many people, in fact, saw this more as a Northern Hemisphere problem, a high-income country problem, rather than a problem that was being experienced on the African continent. So it was difficult to get them to identify as to the need why these sort of measures were required when our hospitals at that stage, at early stage, certainly simply were not overwhelmed. And in fact, very few people knew anyone else other than those few travelers that had come in from Italy that had COVID at that point in time.
That first enforced lockdown lasted for quite a number of weeks.
Oh, correct. That lasted for 5 weeks, level five. And then over time, we went to lower levels of lockdown, but some of the restrictions were still extremely prohibitive in terms of social engagements, as well as the ability of people to earn a living. So much of the formal industry remained shut down for close on to 3 months, resulting in shedding of large numbers of jobs, as an example, increasing the unemployment, which in South Africa sits close at 43% already. So certainly it was phased out over time, simply because the reality didn't allow for it to continue in the same manner that it continued in other countries, such as perhaps New Zealand and Australia.
You mentioned the lack of a social support network or net to help people when they are pushed out of work or just because they're working in this informal sector. So what was the impact on people in the, as you describe, in the economic divide, those who are in the most unequal bit of an unequal society?
Yeah, so, I mean, despite what eventually transpired is one of the reasons why government decided to start relaxing some of the restrictions was that people were pretty much ending up needing to do what was necessary for them to survive. So even during the course of the level five lockdown, the highest levels of lockdown, even so, much of the formal industry remained shut because they were needing to comply with government regulations. What ended up happening in the townships, in the areas, informal settlements, life started to go back to normal, despite COVID pretty much ramping up rather than decreasing in terms of its burden in South Africa at that stage. And that is simply a reality that we were facing, that the regulations that were being imposed on individuals wasn't speaking to the reality of whether people were actually able to adopt those regulations and adhere to those regulations. So when I used to drive down to Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, which is a hospital that my research unit is at, as you're driving down, you would see the streets full of children playing together, despite the schools being shut down because government was afraid that children would end up being infected and infect other members in the household. But on a flip side, these children couldn't stay in a house, which is a small bedroom that accommodates 2-3 people. So they needed to get out and they would be playing with their friends out in the open. So the regulations wasn't speaking to the realities in the country in terms of what was appropriate for the country at the point in time.
So then, obviously, after that initial period of lockdown, things did open up again for all sectors. But further waves of the virus came to South Africa subsequently. So how did the government manage those after that initial experience of the difficulties of sustaining lockdown, given the economic circumstances?
So when we experienced a resurgence in November of 2020, and this was due to the Beta variant, just prior to the resurgence, I think we had gone down to level two restrictions, where society was fairly open by then. Remember, this was close on to 9 months after the pandemic had started. The schools had also been reopened largely. But as soon as the Beta variant evolved, and again, it was first identified in South Africa, there was some sort of a knee-jerk reaction on the part of government, in that they felt that with this new variant of concern, that the best thing to do would be to go back to high levels of lockdown. We didn't go back to level 4 or 5, but we went back to level 4, which was extremely restrictive in terms of what people could do. And this was during a period of the time when South Africa was heading into the holiday season. So again, it started to impact on people's plans for vacations, but more importantly, started to impact again negatively on the economy, in that much of the tourism industry was essentially being shut down overnight again, in reaction to the evolution of the Beta variant of concern. It is only, in fact, much later, and that is with the evolution of the Omicron variant in November of 2021, that there was a fundamental shift on the part of government in the manner in which it reacted to the new variant. But until then, unfortunately, it was sort of a to and fro between different levels of restriction, but in reality, not achieving much. Because despite all the regulations, as I mentioned, a large part of the populace remained compelled not to necessarily adhere to multiple components of what was being asked of them.
Because they couldn't survive, they couldn't, as you say, put bread on the table if they did adhere to those components.
Absolutely. And at that stage, it was no longer that COVID-19 was a foreign concept. It was just affecting people in the Northern Hemisphere. By that stage, by the time we started to experience the Beta variant and even more so with the Delta variant, COVID became a harsh reality with large, large numbers of families being directly affected, losing 1, 2, 3 members in a space of a few weeks. So by that stage, COVID became very much a reality in South Africa in terms of loss of life, in terms of overwhelming of our healthcare facilities. But at the same time, choices needed to be made by the general populace in terms of whether to put bread on the table or to try to adhere to some sort of regulations, trying to slow the spread of the virus, but at the same time not being able to actually have the resources, the means to actually do so.
Did those early lockdowns delay the first major wave until later in 2020?
I wouldn't say so. I think the reality of the first lockdown is that it might have delayed the number of people that were infected probably by maybe 2 or 3 weeks. It certainly didn't delay infections from transpiring. The serous surveys, which were concluded after the first wave due to the wild-type virus, indicated that that stage already close on to 35 to 40% of the population had been infected simply after that initial COVID-19 wave. Clearly, if the lockdowns restrictions had decreased the amount of infections taking place, we wouldn't have had 30 to 40% of the population infected after a single wave. But it did probably lengthen the period of time over which those infections took place, which somewhat assisted the healthcare facilities in terms of preparing for a surge of severe cases.
You describe the hospitals being completely overburdened during 2020 when the largest waves happened and then into 2021. Many commentators at the time have observed that there was less COVID infection in Africa than there was in the Northern Hemisphere. Also, when I say COVID infection, I mean severe COVID disease than there was in the Northern Hemisphere. Does that fit with your experience from being there in South Africa in the middle of all of this?
So the most severe wave in South Africa was during the course of the Delta variant wave, when the population remained completely unvaccinated. And that wave itself was responsible for more than 50% of all of the recorded deaths as well as hospitalization that transpired over a three-year period during the pandemic. So were Africans spared from being infected? And the answer to that is a no, because I think there's multiple studies across the continent now which consistently have shown that after the Omicron variant wave, the BA1 wave, close on to 90 to 95% of people have been infected at least once. And certainly that was our experience in South Africa, is that even before the onset of the Omicron wave, we already showed that close on to 3/4 of the population had been infected at least once during over the course of the initial wave, the Beta variant and the Delta variant wave. So there was large amounts of infections taking place. But there might be some differences across the African countries in relation to the magnitude of severe disease. But we need to be guarded in terms of how we actually look at those numbers. So when you look at hospitalization as well as death, and particularly death, South Africa contributes to more than 45% of all of the recorded COVID-19 deaths across the continent, despite us constituting less than 5% of the African population. So is there something really that unique of South Africa, which is causing a country such as South Africa to contribute to 45% of all deaths on the African continent? And the only real difference between South Africa and many other sub-Saharan African countries is our ability to actually have robust surveillance in place, as well as ability to diagnose cases. That is one of the major differences. South Africa has got an extremely a population that's, again, fairly heterogeneous. It's got the population that's got a high prevalence of some comorbidities, obesity, diabetes. But in other African countries, you've got other sort of comorbidities at play as well, which would also lend them to becoming more susceptible. So has Africa been spared? I think we probably are better off than many other continents, largely mainly driven probably because of the younger age group demographic on the continent. But certainly, there's been a significant undercount, a major undercount in terms of the number of deaths that has transpired on the continent.
I mean, I think there's two points really there. One is the difficulties in understanding burden without good surveillance. But I think the other important point you made was that, as in other populations, younger individuals are much less affected. But of course, the life expectancy is much shorter in most African countries than it is, particularly in Europe and North America. In South Africa, is there a larger proportion of older adults, which might explain the larger number of cases that you described and the hospitals being overburdened?
Well, the life expectancy in South Africa is 65 years, so not very different from many other African countries. But like I said, we probably do have higher prevalence of comorbidities. But in certain demographic groups, people that are whites, people of Indian descent, as an example, the life expectancy in those age, in those demographics is probably in the region of about 70 to 75. And we did see that come through in terms of the initial pattern of mortality, where people of Indian descent, people that were classified as white, they had much higher rates of hospitalization as well as incidence of death from COVID-19 compared to Black Africans. So we did see some of that emerge in South Africa. But at a population level, 80% of the population are Black African, and the life expectancy in that demographic is probably under 65 years of age. So I don't think age alone is the contributing factor to what we saw in South Africa as well as on the African continent.
Of course, one of the other big impacts for the economy in South Africa was the impact that there was on travel. And you mentioned the holiday season, but also there's business travel between South Africa and other parts of the continent, or indeed Europe and North America. I wonder what your reflections are on those travel bans imposed by Northern Hemisphere countries on South Africa, just when you were announcing the emergence of variants with such exquisite detail because of the quality of the surveillance being undertaken there, and it really felt as if South Africa was being punished.
Yeah, certainly, and that was the case during the announcement of the Omicron variant of concern. But paradoxically, what also happened is at an earlier stage, I think when the Delta variant started to gain traction in India and subsequently in Europe, in fact, South Africa itself decided to restrict travels from those countries where the Delta variant was being reported. But over time, we came to understand as a global community that by the time these variants of concern are actually identified, they've probably been in circulation for a reasonable period of time rather than having evolved overnight or the day before it was actually announced. So what appeared to happen is that there wasn't an actual grasp of, and there wasn't any much learning from earlier experiences during the course of the COVID pandemic as to whether this type of restrictions, and especially very selective restrictions, would actually assist a country in avoiding importation of these variants of concern. So what are Omicron variant? As an example, what ended up happening is that the approach that many high-income countries took was to restrict travel from select countries from sub-Saharan Africa, but at the same time, allow for travel from other countries that weren't restricting travel to and from South Africa. And clearly there was other routes to which infections or to which those variants could actually end up in those countries that were imposing the restrictions. But as you made mention of, essentially what transpired is that South Africa as a country were largely being in a sense punished for the scientists being open in terms of sharing with the global community what was considered to be a major event during the course of the pandemic. And that's the evolution of this highly antibody evasive Omicron variant of concern.
Thank you for explaining the situation there. Now, back in the, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, spring of 2020, I asked you to take part in the trials of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, which you agreed to without hesitation. What were your thoughts at the time about getting involved with a vaccine being developed at a university rather than already at the stage of working with a commercial partner?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously engaging directly with university is much less bureaucratic compared with trying to work with a pharmaceutical company. Although I did make some sort of overtures to a pharmaceutical company as well to see whether there was interest on their part in terms of doing this sort of studies at an early stage during the course of the pandemic. And the reason for that, again, is based on experience of the past. Often these vaccines, life-saving vaccines, are not evaluated on African continent until after these vaccines actually become licensed or start being used in high-income countries. And that results in a lag in terms of its introduction. Clearly, what we were facing here was something that we couldn't allow for history to repeat itself. And that's the reason why we started to engage to see whether we could get an early readout as to how these COVID vaccines would work in an African context, such as South Africa, where we've got additional issues, as an example that I've mentioned. Close on to 15-18% of the population are living with HIV, which itself was at that stage considered to be a potential major risk factor for severe COVID. So we certainly welcomed the overtures from on your part and your and the university's part in terms of engaging with us to actually ensure that we could actually do this studies at an early stage. And I think I think our study started just a few weeks after you actually had started enrolling in the UK. And again, it shows commitment to ensure that we actually get sort of an idea how these vaccines work in different contexts rather than just being focused in a particular locality.
As you know, I think very much our shared vision was that the development of the vaccine should be one that led to it being available across all geographies. And so working with you representing the African continent and our colleagues in Kenya was a critical part of that, in addition to the work undertaken in Latin America and in South Asia. So very important from our perspective, and I think that fits very well with the vision you've just outlined there. Obviously, you had huge logistical challenges to then put this in place during lockdowns, during waves of infection affecting your own staff in the trial centres. And I just wonder if you could briefly reflect on the experience of running a major clinical trial with over 2,000 volunteers enrolled in South Africa in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah, so I think there were a number of factors that came into play. Firstly, we obviously built on our expertise over the past 25 years in doing clinical trials. So it put us in a fairly good position to be able to embark on these studies, but certainly not with the speed that we needed to do so. In addition to which, at that stage, at early stage, at a time when COVID-19 started, in fact, one of our bottlenecks to us being able to do any sort of clinical trial in South Africa was the regulatory timelines for approval, both at the ethics committee as well as the South African Products Regulatory Authority. But fortunately, we found that people started to understand the gravity of the situation. And certainly from the regulatory perspective, they indicated that they would be able to do fast tracking of the review of the protocols. And that assisted us in terms of ensuring that we can actually get up to speed as quickly as possible. But effectively, what ended up happening within the research unit itself is that we had a complete sort of change in terms of scope of work as well as responsibilities of individuals, in that we largely stopped working on anything else that we were doing and pretty much pulled all of our resources to ensure that we were able to set up the structure to start embarking on what was then meant to be a 1B phase 2 study on COVID-19 vaccines. Massive mobilization of resources. We were fortunate that together with yourself, we were able to get the necessary funding to ensure that we could actually get a program started. So funding, fortunately, was addressed at an early stage. And when we started the vaccine trial, interestingly, what transpired, which is very different from my past experience, is rather than people being skeptical about the vaccine, we had large numbers of people phoning my own research unit as well as a number of other research units that we brought into the fold, volunteering to be the first in terms of participating in these sort of studies, realizing exactly what was coming ahead. So I think we were just somewhat fortunate in that we were able to leverage on past experiences. A number of other issues align in terms of regulatory processes, in terms of funding, and obviously then the willing partner on your side in terms of ensuring that you assisted us in terms of getting those protocols in place, as well as, I think, the collaborative nature of the manner in which we went about sharing experiences between countries that were involved in this program.
Yes, I think we similarly here in the UK had that same sense of being overwhelmed by the public wanting to take part in the clinical trials to provide their contribution to try to curb the pandemic, and incredibly positive experience for us here in Europe as well as in South Africa and in Latin America, where the experience was very similar. Now, turning the clock forwards, by the end of 2020, the first license was granted for the vaccine which you had worked on with us here in the UK, and then many other countries followed suit over the next few weeks until finally in February of 2021, there was approval by the World Health Organization for a global deployment of the vaccine, and through the COVAX facility, which was set up to help fund and distribute vaccines from various developers around the world. And at that time, you started receiving the first shipments in South Africa to provide the first doses that could be deployed at scale to the population. And just at that moment, you had some results that became available from the trials you've been running showing that there was very poor protection against the Beta variant. And so could you just describe, first of all, the results and then about what happened subsequently?
So the vaccine that became available to South Africa, unfortunately, didn't come through the COVAX facility because COVAX was somewhat lagging behind in terms of being able to procure vaccines and deploy it. And I think this vaccine became available after negotiations between the president of the country in South Africa and the prime minister in India. And it was probably a direct relationship, which eventually allowed for Serum Institute of India to sort of export, I think it was 1.5 million doses of the vaccine to South Africa.
So this is the vaccine that we'd worked on together, the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, but manufactured at Serum Institute.
Correct. So as Serum Institute were producing that vaccine, and again, that was obviously the arrangement with University of Oxford and with AstraZeneca for them to be the producers of the vaccine, especially for low and middle income countries. But the Indian government, as you might recall, had put restrictions in terms of its export at that stage. So some negotiations needed to be held to enable the vaccine to be imported in South Africa, because South Africa had largely put all of its eggs into a single basket in that it expected to get all of its vaccine from the COVAX facility. What transpired is that we actually ended up accruing a large number of endpoint cases as a Beta variant took off in South Africa in our clinical trial. And we found ourselves in a position to unblind, because we had accrued sufficient number of endpoint cases, literally the day before the vaccine was due to arrive in South Africa. And I think the vaccine arrived on Saturday, and we actually unblinded on the Friday. And having a look at the results, it clearly indicated, and it wasn't too much of a surprise because there was some immunogenicity studies that we had done, which had essentially shown that a Beta variant was relatively antibody evasive, and particularly so for the AstraZeneca vaccine. So we weren't too surprised when we did unblind that we actually showed that we didn't have any protection against mild to moderate COVID-19 due to the Beta variant. And I need to emphasize the mild to moderate part, because as I mentioned, this was a phase 1B, phase 2 study. We were relatively risk averse in that we excluded individuals that were considered to be at high risk of developing severe disease at this initial stage of evaluation of the vaccine, and we essentially enrolled a relatively healthy population who weren't at risk of developing severe disease. But that being said, we basically had a readout of no vaccine efficacy against the Beta variant, although the vaccine was shown to protect against wild-type infection. The question then arose was, if the vaccine didn't protect against mild to moderate COVID-19 due to the Beta variant, was it still a reason to believe that a vaccine could still protect against severe disease? And certainly from my own perspective, and given my experience in the past with other vaccines against other respiratory pathogens, generally what we've seen is that most of these vaccines perform much better in protecting against severe disease than protecting simply against infection. But I think there was a sense of euphoria that had been created with results from other countries for other vaccines against the wild-type virus, where they showed a protection of close to 90-95% even against infection. So there were sort of expectations that were created from the earlier vaccine efficacy studies performed elsewhere, which was providing a readout against a wild-type virus, as opposed to what we now faced, where we got a vaccine which wasn't protecting against mild to moderate COVID-19 due to the Beta variant. But then examining the data, and again, the WHO, the SAGE itself, the Scientific Advisory Group of Experts, also evaluated this data, but also looked at other data points, including some animal model studies, which basically indicated that there was a reasonable probability that the vaccine could still possibly protect against severe disease due to the Beta variant, despite it not protecting against mild to moderate COVID-19. And in our own studies, what we showed is that despite the antibody evasiveness of the Beta variant in the relation to the AstraZeneca vaccine, the cell-mediated immunity, the CD8 cytotoxic T lymphocyte responses, was still being relatively preserved. Coupled with that, we had animal model data to suggest that, yes, the vaccine wasn't protecting against the Beta variant infection, but was still protecting the animals in developing severe disease. So those data points coming together indicated there still probably was a role for the AstraZeneca vaccine in a country such as South Africa, and particularly in a context where there was no other vaccine that was an option. So the AstraZeneca vaccine was the only vaccine that was available in the country. At the earliest, the next vaccine was going to come into the country 4 to 6 months into the future in relation to access for the general populace. So we were faced with a situation of needing to make a choice. Use a vaccine for which there was very little concern around safety that could potentially protect against due to the Beta variant, or leave the population unvaccinated and take your chances with the Beta variant or whatever else might come next. And as it transpired, what came next was a Delta variant for which the vaccine has shown high levels of efficacy against severe disease as well as protection against mild to moderate COVID-19. But by the time the Delta variant arrived in South Africa, the government had essentially decided to discard all of the AstraZeneca vaccines by selling it off to the African Union to deploy into other African countries where the Beta variant was also dominating.
I think that looking from the perspective today, it's not so surprising that a new variant emerges which can cause infection, because that's how the virus is surviving, by a mutation that allows continuing infection. But what we don't see anywhere else in the world is severe disease, because the immunity that we've built up from vaccination and past infection still protects us all from severe disease. And that was the case, of course, in South Africa at the time that this decision was made to not use the AstraZeneca vaccine. As you say, it almost certainly left a large number of people unvaccinated who could potentially have been protected with those doses.
Absolutely. And in fact, the back of the envelope calculation indicates that we use at 1.5 million doses of vaccine and targeted to high-risk groups before the onset of the Delta variant, close on to 60,000 lives would have been saved. Had we just targeted high-risk individuals, people above the age of 65 and other major comorbidities, given them a single shot of the AstraZeneca vaccine, their lives would have been spared during the course of the Delta variant. So it was a catastrophic miscalculation on the part of government. And it went against the opinion of many scientists in the country that advocated that despite the disappointing results of the vaccine against the Beta variant in relation to not protecting against mild to moderate COVID-19, in the absence of any other option, that we should still take our chances with a safe vaccine and at least offer it to those high-risk individuals that would be related.
It's very chilling to think of those numbers. That sort of impact could have been had if the vaccine had been deployed. Of course, not absolutely clear why the government went in that direction, given, as you say, the WHO view and scientists within the country. It's, in many other countries, we've seen vaccines quite politicized. Do you think that was the case here, or was it just the uncertainty?
Well, I wouldn't say it was necessarily politicized in South Africa. I think, unfortunately, it was just informed by poor decision-making on the part of government, as well as, unfortunately, on the part of the advisors to government at that point in time. One of the political dimensions of COVID-19 in South Africa is that it did become politicized insofar as when scientists were willing to speak up against some of what government was doing, which wasn't following the science, essentially. Those scientists were, government attempted to sideline those scientists, who often ended up being the ones that were doing much of the research around COVID-19, including vaccines. So there was sort of a politicization in terms of whose opinion government was listening to. And unfortunately, it wasn't very calculated in terms of the type of opinions that were being forwarded, as well as the decisions that resulted from those opinions.
Fast forward to today, what proportion of South Africa has been vaccinated with a COVID vaccine at this point in time?
It's a disappointingly low number, and that's not because of any issues in terms of access to vaccines. It's less than 40% of the population that have received at least a single dose of vaccine. So the large majority of South Africans are unvaccinated, but over time they've had multiple infections due to the virus, and there's been widespread infection-induced immunity.
And of course, now that people are immune through infection and some through vaccination, there is much less of an impetus to try and increase that rate from 40%. It has very little additional benefit.
Absolutely. I mean, there's complacency which has crept in. And I think infection-induced immunity has been shown to protect reasonably well against severe disease. And people don't have the same sort of experience which they had during 2021 when we were facing the Delta variant, where there were massive numbers of hospitalization taking place on a daily basis, when the number of people that were dying were running into the hundreds each day. And certainly that is something in a somewhat distant past now in the memory of individuals. And the number of people that end up in hospitals due to COVID-19 nowadays in South Africa, despite the modest vaccine coverage, is really, really very few.
That's extremely good news and good points to end this podcast. Shabir, thank you so much for joining us, for being part of this podcast, and for all that you continue to do for human health, fighting against other respiratory infections particularly. And a personal thanks from me for sharing the experience of the pandemic with me from South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. And thank you, Bill, for yourself and your team for being forthcoming and including us in those vaccine trials.
Thank you very much. That was the Oxford Colloquy. Thanks for joining us in our podcast, bringing you the facts, stories, and people behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? We've called this podcast series the Oxford Colloquy. Well, a colloquy is a discourse or a conversation, and hopefully you'll agree that that's what we've been having.